Ladies and gentlemen, the acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Rumors that I'm going to set the place on fire or blow it up or lock the doors are completely false.
But there are going to be some changes from American public media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, November 27th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Mick Mulvaney reported for work today as the acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Leandra English, the person put in that very same job by outgoing director Richard Cordray over the Thanksgiving break, went up to Capitol Hill today to meet with Senators Elizabeth Warren and Chuck Schumer. So Mulvaney was the one who got to address the CFPB troops, as it were, in front of the cameras. We are going to leave the legal fight over who is eventually going to wind up in that job to others. And staying in our lane here, play the next thing Mulvaney said today after he said he's not going to burn the place down.
I'm a member of the executive branch of government. We intend to execute the laws of the United States, including the provisions of Dodd-Frank that govern the CFPB. That being said, the way we go about it, the way we interpret it, the way we enforce it will be dramatically different under the current administration than it was under the last. Anybody who thinks that a Trump administration CFPB would be the same as an Obama administration Trump CFPB is simply being naive. Elections have consequences at every agency, and that includes the CFPB.
So bearing in mind that President Trump has called the CFPB a disaster, that's a quote, and Mr. Mulvaney has called it a sick, sad joke, also a quote, what does their kind of consumer protection look like? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
Two people, two very different takes on the CFPB. Actually, same word to describe it.
Incredibly effective.
Extremely effective.
First up, Rachel Weintraub with the Consumer Federation of America.
For example, it has obtained $12 billion in refunds to almost 30 million Americans who were harmed by a large financial institution.
Second take, less positive, from Diane Katz with the Heritage Foundation.
They have promulgated a great many rules, many of which have made consumer financial products and services more costly and harder to obtain.
Trump has been vocal about his dislike for the CFPB, but he can't quite wish it away. It was created by Congress and so can't just be shuttered. The open question is how much he could hollow it out, such that a later administration couldn't just change everything back again. Andrew Metrick is at the Yale School of Management.
I think it's that easy, absent changing the statute, to have a long-term impact on the ability of the CFPB to do its job.
Still, consumer advocates are worried. Lauren Saunders is with the National Consumer Law Center.
We will probably see much more lax enforcement against banks charging deceptive fees, debt collectors abusing people, student lenders not applying people's payments correctly. We may even see lawsuits have been filed drop.
She says rolling back existing rules is trickier and would take longer, but that's also possible. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Just because there is not enough going on in Washington this week, Congress is back from its Thanksgiving break, and Republicans are doing their best to tweak their tax plan to get enough votes to get the thing through the Senate. That means political horse trading, and in a new report from the Congressional Budget Office this weekend, what it's going to mean dollars-wise to repeal the Obamacare individual mandate as the Senate bill as it stands now does. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more on how the CBO sees the numbers.
The CBO looked at how repealing the mandate and other tax bill changes might play out across various income levels.
In the early years, it would hurt low-income families.
Elizabeth Lauer-Bosch is with the Center for Law and Social Policy.
It would have modest positive effects for some middle-income families, and it would give huge benefits to the wealthiest families.
The numbers look particularly bad for those towards the bottom of the income scale, says Luke Schaefer, director of the Poverty Solutions Project at the University of Michigan.
For households below $30,000, in just the next few years, they're going to see sort of their net benefits decrease.
The CBO argument is that without the mandate, poor people who leave Obamacare won't get the subsidy benefits, therefore will see an overall loss in how much they get from the government.
They will, quote-unquote, lose money. If they choose to leave Obamacare, they will no longer get an Obamacare reimbursement check.
Brian Riedel of the Manhattan Institute disagrees with the way the CBO ran these numbers.
That is scored as a tax increase, oddly, but it's not something where it's actually costing these people any money.
So while the benefits of the Senate tax plan still skew towards the wealthy, it doesn't necessarily mean the poor will be paying more out of pocket. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, a couple of blips and then mostly flatline, really. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Regular and attentive listeners to this broadcast will know that Koch Industries supports our programming from time to time. So consider that disclosure as we talk about the big media story of the day, the nearly $3 billion purchase of Time Incorporated by Iowa-based Meredith of Better Homes and Gardens fame, among other titles. It's a deal with a lot of layers, some specifically media-related, some with political overtones. Sydney Ember wrote about it for the New York Times today. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
We should say this is the second time Meredith has tried to buy Time magazine. Why do they want this deal so much?
Well, it's actually at least the third time they've tried to buy Time Inc. You know, I think they want Time Inc. because it has a lot of titles that they want. But most importantly, it has People magazine, which is, you know, perhaps the most profitable magazine in the country. And that sort of seems to be what they've been after since basically 2013 when they started.
Yeah. Arguably, the reason the deal went through this time was because of the $650 million that the Koch brothers, through their private equity development arm, have put in. What is in it for the Koch brothers then?
Well, at this point, it's a little bit unclear what's in it for the Kochs. They have said this is a passive investment. They don't have a seat on the board, and they don't intend to influence the magazines. But if you know anything about the Kochs, they do try to sort of influence public discourse, and there is the thought that whatever they're saying now, they will wield some influence over the magazines, if just by sort of being there. In a way, they also say that this is an investment opportunity. Their private equity arm does a lot of investments, and what they've told me, or what their spokesman has told me, is they evaluate a lot of investments, and this was the one that happened to be the right choice at the right time. But again, I think there's a lot of skepticism in the media world, especially about what their real intentions are.
Yeah, does it pass the smell test that they pay $650 million and then are completely hands-off on this thing?
It does not. Not to me. And, you know, mostly not to the people I've talked to. I think, you know, everybody knows the media business and the magazine industry is maybe not the best investment these days if you're looking to make money. So who knows?
Yeah. It's a broad audience that Meredith now has, right? 130 something million people reading these magazines, paid subscribers in the tens of millions. It combines nicely with the Koch brothers' data enterprise as well, right? Just this readership information that they now get.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that a number of people have told me is the Koch network has a data analysis company called i360 that they use in elections. So they have all this voter data, and magazine companies like Time Inc. and Meredith have a ton of consumer information. And you can only imagine the possibilities if you combine those two, the kinds of targeting you can do, maybe for, you know, advertisers and also potentially for, you know, political interests.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go. Is this a done deal, or is it going to get held up somehow, antitrust, or I don't even know, what have you?
Well, you know, certainly you never know these days what might happen in the media industry, but I think that the expectation is this deal does go through. People aren't really foreseeing any regulatory challenges, and Time Inc. and Meredith both expect the deal to close in the first quarter of next year.
Sydney Ember covers media for the New York Times. Sydney, thanks a lot.
Yep, thanks for having me.
We had Charles Koch on the program a couple of years ago. You can hear that at marketplace.org or the whole hour-long interview that we did on our Corner Office podcast. This is supposed to be harvest season for citrus growers down in Florida. I say supposed to be because there's not actually a whole lot of picking and boxing of oranges going on right now. The 100-plus mile-an-hour winds from Hurricane Irma plowed right up the south-central part of that state, Florida's agricultural heartland, in particular, its orange groves. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman went down to see how citrus is doing.
I'm visiting with Paul Medder, a fourth-generation citrus grower, in one of his orange groves in southwest Florida. He supplies juice oranges to Florida's Natural. This grove covers 500 acres inland from the ritzy resorts on the Gulf Coast. It's row upon row of trees surrounded by dense oak forest and swampland.
This is where the eye wall of the storm passed over, so looking across here, we've cleaned a lot of things up already, but a lot of broken limbs and other things still laying around.
So that is a whole tree in a backloader, huh?
It is. One of thousands that he'll be removing in this block.
Medder says back in September, when Hurricane Irma blew through, it flooded the groves and toppled mature trees laden with fruit.
I would guess two-thirds of our crop is gone, either because of tree loss or simply the fruit was shaken out of the trees. So now we have to fund another entire crop year. It's going to be a very challenging 24 months to come.
It's also a challenging time for orange pickers, says Gerardo Reyes Chavez. He's an organizer at the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a farm worker advocacy group headquartered about a half an hour from Medder's operation.
You cannot replant a tree. That's just a season that's completely destroyed for all the orange groves. Thousands of workers without a job. So it's hard.
Andrew Meadows is with Florida Citrus Mutual, the state trade organization for growers.
We were facing the fight of our lives before Irma.
That's because of crop losses over a decade or more from something called citrus greening. It's a bacteria spread by a tiny invasive insect that saps the orange trees of nutrients, ruining the fruit and weakening the trees.
A dozen years ago, we were at 242 million boxes of oranges. Last year, we produced about 69 million.
There's no cure for citrus greening, but ag scientists have made progress mitigating its damage for growers like Medder, whose trees were healthy this year. And the industry was hoping 2017 would be a turnaround year. Instead, Meadows says growers have lost half their crop statewide to Hurricane Irma at an estimated cost of $760 million.
They had already spent on fertilizer and pesticides and that sort of thing for this upcoming year, so that money's gone. And if we don't receive a relief rebuild package, there are going to be a mass exodus from the industry.
He means a relief rebuild package from Congress, federal disaster funding dedicated specifically to help Florida's devastated citrus industry. The state's congressional delegation has been pushing hard for this, says Max Moody, spokesperson for Republican Representative Tom Rooney.
There really isn't a program in place at the moment to indemnify direct crop loss with specialty crops.
Relief funding for citrus hasn't made it into the two disaster bills passed by Congress so far, and it's not included in the White House's latest supplemental request either.
You know, what's available to them if we don't get in the supplemental? The answer's not a lot, not much.
Orange imports to the U.S. from Central and South America are on track to nearly double this year. And that cup of orange juice you like to drink in the morning? It's been affected, too. Orange juice futures are up about 25% since Hurricane Irma hit, and that could mean higher prices at the store as well. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You can't expect English people to see any value in the Cornish language. They just don't care about us.
There's a Cornish word for Brexit, too. Go figure that one out. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up about a 10% today, 22 points, 23,580 for the blue chips. The Nasdaq off That same 10th percent, 10.6878. S&P 500 pretty much flat, 2601. We told you about Time and Meredith. Time up 9.4% today. Meredith, which owns television stations and magazines, including Family Circle, besides Better Homes and Gardens, rose 10.7% today. Trunk Incorporated, also a media publishing company, despite its name, up 1% today. In the battle for speed among the biggest grocers, Walmart and Kroger are cracking down on their food suppliers. Empty shelves cost them some $75 million annually in lost sales, it turns out. Walmart flat today is imposing a $500 fine for deliveries that are more than 2 days late. Kroger up 0.8%, charging monthly fines of 3% for late deliveries. Supply chain management, yo. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Today in the future is coming for you, whether you're ready or not, Shell Oil. Last month, the company announced it's buying the big European electric vehicle charging network NewMotion. Now, it's got a new partnership that's going to bring EV charging stations to dozens of Shell gas stations across Europe. From the sustainability desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim explains how Shell is going to stay sustainable.
Working with several major automakers, Shell will put super high-speed chargers at 80 Shell stations. How high speed? 5 to 7 minutes. But why would an oil company push electric cars? I asked Istvan Kapitani, head of global retail for Shell. He says because Shell isn't just an oil company, it's an energy company.
We are trying to be satisfying the needs of our consumers, and that is clear that quite a significant number of customers are moving to electric vehicles.
They're recognizing that electric vehicles are happening.
Lisa Jerram analyzes EVs for Navigant Research. She says they'll make up at least 10% of new sales within a decade, and Shell needs to stake a claim on that future.
Why not go ahead and establish yourself and sort of establish your brand, have people become associating your brand with electric vehicles?
There's another big reason for Shell to draw EV drivers to its stations. Gil Tall directs research for the Institute of Transportation Studies at UC Davis. He says, unlike in the U.S., Shell owns its stations in Europe and needs to get people in the door.
They buy more than just gas. And if they have more and more electric car drivers who are not visiting the station at all or visiting very rarely, you know, they lose customers for their convenience store.
Because everyone knows gas stations don't make money on fuel. It's fuzzy dice, sodas, and those delicious ice cream bars you sneak on the drive home and then destroy the evidence. I'm Jed Kim from Marketplace.
Quote economic headlines until the cows come home. But the truth is, if people aren't feeling good about their own economic day-to-day, then pretty much nothing else matters. That's the idea behind our series, My Economy, How People Are Getting By Out There. Today's dispatch comes to us from upstate New York.
My name's Robert Engel. I'm number 7 of 9 children. You know, being from such a large family, I was always expected to do the cooking. That's an interest that has just stayed with me. For 20, 22 years, I was a curator, mostly at historic house museums, and then the executive director at a couple of museums. I was looking for museum jobs in the city, and my wife was saying, why do that? You are more interested in this other thing. It, you know, the books you read are about food and wine. And so I had just been the executive director of a county historical society, and the next thing I knew, I was the cellar rat at Balthazar Restaurant in New York. My wife, Judy, was very happy to support the two of us while I was doing this. You know, I went from having a decent salary to getting minimum wage in the first job. The wine and food revolution in New York City really has never trickled upstate. And so upstate, I'm in a place where I can make a difference. In New York City, I am just one more food and wine guy. In the Adirondacks, I'm a superhero.
Robert Engel there in upstate New York. If you've got an economic story, and we all do, right? Send it our way, marketplace.org/myeconomy. The European Union seems to have just about had it with British Prime Minister Theresa May. Today, the EU gave May until Monday to sweeten the pot of money the UK is going to pay to get out of the European Union before they will agree to start talking about any future trade relationship between London and the continent. But cold, hard economics, important as they are only part of the Brexit story. Culture is on the line, too. Specifically for us today, the Cornish language, an offshoot of Celtic that was spoken across Britain before the Romans got there. So from the Cornish village of Haymore, Stephen Beard reports.
Once labelled a dead language by the UN, Cornish has been staging something of a revival.
Cobber, hearken, sten, sten, sten.
In this village hall, more than a dozen speakers are trying to breathe even more life back into this ancient tongue.
And Gwelasten in Cano!
With gusto, they rehearse a play about the traditional tin and copper miners of Cornwall. Enthusiasts like these have helped over the past decade or so to drag Cornish back from the brink of extinction. Loveday Jenkin is a leading campaigner for Cornish.
There are hundreds of people who are fluent in the language and thousands of people who can hold a conversation.
A mini revival, says Jenkin, that's partly due to European Union funding supplied before the vote for Brexit, financing language classes and even bilingual street signs to promote Cornish.
Which actually enabled it to raise its profile above being a subculture of a few people in Cornwall to something that was actually integral to the identity of Cornwall.
And therefore, the vote for Brexit is a setback.
In my view, it is a setback for the language.
And laver coth, you laver gweer. Never a dose maz a davis right here.
Poet Mays, Paul Hodge is also worried about the effect of Brexit on his beloved language.
Mays, dain hep tavis a golazy deer.
That line, by the way, means he who loses his tongue loses his land. The UK should have more public money to spend after Brexit because it pays far more into the EU than it gets back. But Hodge does not believe that any of that cash will find its way into Cornish culture.
You can't expect English people to see any value in the Cornish language. They just don't care about us.
But countries elsewhere in the European Union do.
Yeah, absolutely.
But why depend on the kindness of strangers? Isn't there a good commercial case in Britain for investing in Cornish? After all, interest in Celtic culture is alive and kicking. Vigorous displays of Cornish dancing, singing and even wrestling proved a big hit with the tourists at this recent Celtic festival. Cornwall, a poor county, is utterly dependent on tourism. Along with the spectacular scenery, rugged headlands and sparkling sea views, the language has a part to play in this, says local academic Gareth Tregisher.
Having a way of actually branding and marketing Cornwall on both the UK and the international scene is important. Cornish language enables us to promote Cornwall as a place apart, and that's important in the marketplace.
The marketplace could solve the lack of funding for the language after Brexit.
Imurez, Nav Cavallo, a Kelly's Cornish ice cream, agu, as tasty as.
This TV ad for a local ice cream in English and Cornish has been aired across the UK. A local beer company has started to do the same, and money is beginning to trickle in from corporate sponsorship, says campaigner Loveday Jenkin.
Businesses are starting to realise the value of the language and actually starting to support it a bit. With the decline in government and taxpayers' money, the language community is looking more to business to help support things that we're doing.
She's confident the language will not die. After all, it survived the Roman conquest and the Anglo-Saxon invasion. It's still alive and adapting. It's even coined a word for the latest threat, Breton Bwrdd, the Cornish for Brexit. In Cornwall, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today for those of you who do the Christmas tree thing, and a story which is, interestingly enough, at least a little bit about the long tail of the Great Recession. From the San Francisco Chronicle, this item: Christmas tree prices are up again this year as much as 5 to 10%. How come? Well, it takes about 10 years to grow a tree to market size, according to the National Christmas Tree Association. Plantings went down as the recession started in 2007. Supply, demand, that whole thing. All right, we got to go. The Dow up about a tenth percent today, 22 points. The Nasdaq down a tenth, 10 points there. S&P 500 basically flat. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Haley Hirschman, and Daisy Palacios. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.